time, in particular death. And so we have to be able to combat initial grief and shock. Those are really good for people, especially mothers who might be confronted with, you know, a child who's been killed or, you know, all these things that we're confronted with. Ignatia in particular is really good for initial grief. So that's a really good one to just have on hand. And milk thistle. I have to go because it's like that time. I want people to stay tuned for Solidarity, Not Charity. And this is Iyapo Ngina, your host for Colonialism is Bad for Your Health. I want to say all power to the people, black power to the African community. Uhuru.
Uhuru, and welcome to Solidarity, Not Charity. Solidarity, Not Charity is the radio show of the African People's Solidarity Committee, the organization of white people that works under the leadership and was formed by the African People's Socialist Party. And we want to thank the party and Uhuru Radio and Uhuru News for allowing us to have this show every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Today on Solidarity, Not Charity, we are very honored to have with us Chimurenga Waller, former international president of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement and current head of the Education Committee of NPEDM. Welcome, Chimurenga.
Uhuru.
Uhuru. So as NPEDM builds towards the annual convention of NPEDM to be held here in St. Petersburg, Florida at the Uhuru House, and just about a month from now, I think a month from this weekend, September 27th and 28th, Uhuru Radio is discussing as its weekly theme different aspects of the platform of NPEDM. So this week we're talking about education, and of course we could have no better expert than the movement expert on the question of education and somebody who's run for school board in Pinellas County and is known in this county as a person that stands for, in particular, the questions of education affecting African people and students. It's very much an honor to have Chimurenga Waller. The question of education is very critical to the struggle for African workers, and some of the statistics show that the public school system is very clearly a colonial system, and it begins in childhood as a way of tracking African children towards the prison system or generally to maintain them under colonial domination. I was reading, and we were talking a little bit before the show, that nationally, the official statistic is something like only 56% of African young people really graduate from high school. So this is outrageous. And I know that you have a deeper insight into those statistics anyway. So let's. I'd like to begin by asking you some questions and have you talking to us today. Barack Obama is telling African children to go to school and get an education. Mm-hmm. But tell us about the conditions that African children really face in the public schools today.
Well, before we do that, Penny, if I could, I think it would be helpful to help define what education, what purpose it serves in society.
Excellent.
And for all the hoopla that many people raise around education, its purpose is to give workers the minimum amount of education to carry out labor in society, and also give workers the ideological underpinning of that society. So it serves those basic two purposes. If you think about it very hard, people go to school so they can carry out labor, because labor is the linchpin of all societies. That's how wealth is developed, through labor. So education is to educate workers to that minimum level of understanding so they can carry out labor in society. I think that's important to say, because many times, particularly in the African community, we hear people say, well, you know, you should stop struggling and just get a good education and you get a good job. But if we are correct that explanation for what purpose education serves in society is correct, and we believe it is correct, then clearly it's more than about just going to school, getting that ideological underpinning. Because what does pledging allegiance to the American flag have to do with education?
Right.
They do that every day. Right. So I think clearly we can prove that part of the task of education is that ideological underpinning to give people the ideas of society and keep them loyal when against their own self-interest.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that's really helpful, and I'm glad you put that out. And I think that a couple things about that I'd like to have you comment on. First of all, it's really clear that in this country there is a two-tiered education system, and that the education system that most white people experience, even within the same physical schools, is very different than what African people does. And I also think that it's interesting when you say that the schools are there to get people ready for the labor they'll do in society, that the schools that African children go to are police states, and the majority probably of labor done by the African community today is in prison.
Right. The fact that we're talking about part of the relationship of prisons later on today in the meeting that we have every day, we'll be talking about the relationship of education to prisons. And clearly, if you look at the devastating statistics of Africans, and I'm glad you mentioned the question about education of Africans and white people in the same school even. Because in the county where we are at, Pinellas County, Florida, they spent $110 million on new schools. Many of those schools were what they call, they have these special schools called magnet schools. And the actual stated task of the magnet schools is to attract white people to the African community. In this county, 7 of 9 magnet schools are in the African community. So clearly its task had nothing to do with educating Africans. They spent $110 million to build new schools that would then serve the white population. They would just have to come to the African community to get that. I think clearly, if you look at even the statistics in Florida, I think they say that 3% of the children that are targeted toward low-performing classes and classes for mentally handicapped, about 3% of those students are African. About 0.68% of those students are white. So we can see that it's a two-tiered that kind of shows that they point people in a certain direction, and many times it has nothing to do with their ability. Many times it has to do with their so-called disciplinary problems that they define. Many times they use the question of defiance as a disciplinary measure. If you don't react when they don't want you to react, then the Africans are labeled with defiance. And these labels follow these Africans throughout their whole school careers. So even as you approach college, then you find more Africans in prison than you will in college.
Yes.
So clearly, it's not only a two-tier system, it's a system that is built in obstacles to it for the African children. Mm-hmm.
And that starts in kindergarten.
It starts
the
very early.
The designation of problem children and
very
children
early,
geared
very
towards
early.
Foster care. Yeah.
I was actually an employee of the Pinellas County School System for some 4 years, and I tutored kindergarten through third grade. And it was very interesting to see how the Africans were, of course, many of these students were African because they claimed these were underperforming students. And I watched as they would send these students, very bright children, to these classes that they have defined as a way to bring them up to grade level. I have a thought about what these schools not only do to the children who are failing, but what it does to the children that they claim make it through.
Right.
Because I think it fails all of them. Because if you come out of a school system with the ideological underpinning that I talked about earlier of an enemy state, then clearly you have not succeeded. But they are defining that as success. If you make it through high school, get a high school diploma, then you are successful. And we're saying, you are not successful even if you get a high school diploma. You're still deprived, don't understand your own culture, don't understand anything about your own people. And many times you end up being an enemy against your own people.
Yes. Well, I think that I think that what you're saying is that a lot of times the brightest students are the ones that are targeted because they're questioning, they're resisting,
right.
They have a lot may have a kind of consciousness,
right.
African consciousness,
right.
But ones that make it through and, quote, do it the way the system wants are equally devastated on every level and had to basically sell out their community in order to get there.
Exactly.
So, I think that's really an important point. And, you know, the whole question of neocolonialism and the class that's there to help carry out the oppression of the African community. Some of the conditions that African children face in schools, I know I was reading recently about corporal punishment, which takes place and is legal in several states of the United States still, quite a few.
Right.
And I was reading an article that something like the vast majority, of course, of the students that are the recipients of corporal punishment beatings in school are African. And some of the other conditions, can you talk about police and...
Well, of course, I live in Pinellas County, so I have a great deal of information. Most of my information comes from Pinellas County, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing because Pinellas County is one of the lowest 10 performing districts in the United States as far as graduation of African men. So,
give us the statistics.
Well, they say about 30% of African men in Florida graduate with diplomas. In Pinellas County, they've estimated about 25%. Now, 30% is the number for Florida overall. 25% is the number for Pinellas County, where we live. So it's one of the 10 lowest performing school districts in the United States.
Yes.
And this is compared with places like Detroit with more than 1 million people, New York with 8 million people. these are huge school districts, mm-hmm. and here's a school district with 100,000 students, a place with less than 1 million people in the whole county, and these kind of numbers are compared with these giant school districts. It's just a terrible, vicious cycle, and it started a long time ago. And unfortunately, the path to the miseducation of our children started with a lawsuit that was supposed to fight the inequities of physical inequities, books, that kind of thing, facilities. In 1964, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit against the Pinellas County School Board. That lawsuit was essentially saying there was not equal education. It was an equal protection lawsuit. There was not equal protection in far as education was concerned between, and it was the whole separate but equal was inherently unequal. Mm-hmm. It was a version of that lawsuit. So in 1971, they win the lawsuit, and a federal court creates a court order that says this is the remedy for all the harm that's been done to these African children. You'll be bussed out of your community. This is how we're going to help. You'll be bussed out of your community. And for the next 30-some years, you will always be in the minority in the school system. And your failure will go down. And every year that you're in Pinellas County schools, your achievement will go down. Mm-hmm. That has been the practical result of forcing Africans into a school system. Because before integration, what we had was essentially a nominal control over the schools in the African community. Mm-hmm. Did they have great books? No, they were getting hand-me-down books. But the difference was the children were actually being educated. So many times it's not about how great the books are, but about who is teaching the children, how they're pushing them, what it is that they're trying to teach them. And clearly that's been proven over the last 30-some years, where we see this tremendous failure of African students, where in this county only a third of them graduate with actual diplomas, a third get these so-called certificates of attendance, which are worthless, and a third of them are actually kicked out of the system altogether.
What is the state of the situation in the Pinellas County schools since the end of busing, which has been 2 years now, I think?
Well, we don't want to get confused about what they have called the end of busing. Okay. I think it was 5 years ago that they actually had a big headline in the St. Petersburg Times newspaper. It said, busing ends. But that was actually not true, because the choice plan that was created by the school superintendent at the time, Howard Hinesley, created what they called a choice plan. It had a very strange name, choice plan, and it was supposed to increase the options for parents to educate their children. Effectively, what they did is say, what you can do is choose three schools, your top choice, second, and third choice, and you give it to us, and then if that school is not more than 35% African, you would have a chance, as he termed it. He would always use these tricky terms. Now the black children will have a chance to go to school closer to home. But what actually happened was busing increased, mm-hmm. and that program cost about $25 million just in transportation alone. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a program to educate anyone or bring African children back to their own community, because we believe part of the problem here is, one, Africans have been separated. Because let me say this quickly. Before the system of integration started, African schools were part of the fabric of the African community. We knew the teachers knew the parents. So it wasn't like a bunch of strangers mm-hmm. interacting. It was a part of a puzzle of a community. It was a vital part of that community. the boots of the club was all African. The parents fed the football players and basketball players, and that's how tightly knit the whole thing was. And Gibbs High School, which was an all-African school at the time, was a central part of the life of the community, not just in sports, but academics as well. Produced a number of great scholars from that school. And now it has a big fancy school that they rebuilt totally, has a magnet program that is mostly white, and the people are totally alienated from it. It has no connection whatsoever to the African community. It's just in the African community. That's the only connection that it has, a physical connection that it's in our community.
And it's interesting that the situation that you're talking about, the integration, quote unquote, of the schools, coincides with other plans of development, quote unquote, like tearing down the gas plant
right.
to build the dome,
right.
which is what, less than a half a mile from Gibbs
right.
High School,
right.
and you know, just the whole plan to disperse and take away the coherent nature of the African community.
Well, I think it also was a part of that plan when the white school board, which is part of the white imperialist state, says that we want to help, and the way we want to help is spend $110 million on new schools in the African community to give the black children a chance to go to school closer to home, then you know something is in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were building those new schools because they knew in the very near future the Africans wouldn't be there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen is a decrease in the African total African population in the city of St. Petersburg in the last 10 years has actually went down about 5,000,
mm-hmm.
about 5,000 or so African residents. We've seen a gerrymandering of a majority city council district that lost 1,500 black voters through the gerrymandering of a black city councilman. And nobody raised a peep about this, and we supposed to believe that this is coincidental and has no relationship to white people continuing to move in the African community, speculate property.
Yes.
So that says no relationship to building these new schools, which are predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that clearly it is connected to an overall plan. We can see the connection between the attempt to move downtown all the way to 34th
yes.
Street, moving west, and coincidentally, many of these schools are in that same area.
Yes, so as NPEDM and the African People's Socialist Party and Chairman Omalia Shatela pointed out, so there's a complete connection between the situation for education, the taking away of the land that was historically the African community, the dispersal of the African community through gentrification, and the murders of young teenagers, African teenagers like Javon Dawson and others.
That's important to note because the city of St. Petersburg is a very developed city at the moment. It is 95%, according to the city of St. Petersburg's numbers, is 95% built out. And what that means is 5% of the property is left for development in the whole city of St. Pete. Now, what does that mean? It means that to develop, you have to take property where somebody is already living on. Whose property will you take? Well, you're going to take the property of the powerless. The people who you feel like don't have the clout
mm-hmm.
to fight back. And that's always been the African community. That's why we would see a move down 18th Avenue, not just to build the so-called economic development project Sweet Bay, but also take property that had nothing to do with Sweet Bay, and then say the reason you took that is to build an economic corridor down 18th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
What economic corridor? That's going to be controlled by who? Controlled by white people, just like the Sweet Bay is controlled by white people under the guise of being under the control by this African Daryl Roussan.
Right.
It was very strange that even as they were promoting it, as they were building it, the people that you would contact to even rent a place at Sweet Bay grocery store in that complex was Simbler Corporation, not Daryl Russo. So very clearly, these kind of so-called sweetheart deals with neo-colonial forces in the African community play a part in the miseducation of our children, but it plays a part in the inability of our people to create economics inside our own community and commerce in our, inside our own community, because this is related to education. How can a child coming up through elementary school look around in this community and say, I want to be just like this African who created a grocery store on the corner, just like this African who has a barbershop? They can't do that because those places don't exist. So it's very much connected. The economics is very much connected to the educational situation in the whole county.
Well, I think that's really important analysis and information that you're putting out. And you were talking about, you mentioned a little bit earlier, the lawsuit that NPDOM initiated against Pinellas County School System. Tell us what exactly that was about, and there's some amazing statistics connected to that. And what is the status of that lawsuit today?
Well, that lawsuit was filed in the year 2000, and it essentially said, actually one of our members was the primary plaintiff in that lawsuit. A couple of years later, we added several other plaintiffs. But the basic tenet of that lawsuit said that African children were not being educated in Pinellas County. And, of course, this sent the school board into a tizzy because, well, their first response to the lawsuit was, well, this is not something unknown. These statistics that you're putting out are not unknown. So what's the big deal? But as their attempts to get the lawsuit kicked out of court, kicked up to federal court, and kicked out of the court's period, failed, then they had to take it more seriously. The case is known as Crowley versus Pinellas County School Board, although Ms. Crowley is not effectively a plaintiff in that suit primarily anymore. It's still Crowley versus Pinellas County School Board. One of the statistics that was pointed out, and these were statistics that came from the Pinellas County school system and then were reanalyzed by a PhD statistician named Robert Bardwell in Denver. And one of the things that he analyzed in his report and that really helped it push it through the courts was that the chance of this not being racially motivated, the failure of African children not being racially motivated, was the same chance as winning the Colorado lottery 12 times in a row with the same ticket. Now, we know that the same, the chance of winning the lottery itself by with one number is astronomical. To win it 12 times in a row with the same number is impossible. We know that. So clearly he was making these points even among the statistical kind of scientific information. He used those kind of points to point out the devastating kind of effect that this miseducation is having on African children in this county.
I think it's really important and precedent setting.
Well, it is. It's raised eyebrows all over the U.S. The reason I keep talking about Pinellas County, one reason is because that lawsuit is being watched by education experts all over the United States who fear that Africans will get it in their heads that they can do the same thing where they live at and file lawsuits against these school boards that are not educating our children. I did an interview a couple of years ago with Education Magazine. Some years ago, they were there in Ohio. They were very interested in the case, and people are sitting back really waiting for it to happen. It has kind of meandered its way through the court system. We expect it to go to trial at least by early next year.
Excellent.
So after almost 9 years, We've kind of forced it to the table, so we do believe it'll be going to court by early next year.
Excellent. I can't wait to well, see that.
Well, I'm sure
that,
the courtroom, you know, is going to be packed and everybody will be watching.
Okay, I think we're going to take a little break. And our comrade Sandy Thompson from African People Solidarity Committee, who's engineering the show today, is here to give us a few announcements. Uhuru, Sandy.
Uhuru. Uhuru, having an excellent program today, and we do want to let people know that if you are out there listening and you would like to participate in activities of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, the African People Solidarity Committee, in solidarity with the struggle for African liberation, freedom, and independence for African people, there are a number of ways that you can do that on this upcoming weekend. Saturday, September 6th, here in St. Petersburg, I'll start with St. Pete first, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is hosting an event on the Barack Obama campaign. Under the theme of the event is, Can Barack Obama Really Bring the Hope and Change That We Need? And Penny Hess, who is hosting the program today, African People Solidarity Committee chairwoman, is going to be delivering a slide presentation on the various aspects of the Obama campaign, the backers, the financiers, his program, his platform, his statements, his track record, to really look at the issues, because what we're seeing is that people are swept away with emotion about the Barack Obama campaign and forgetting about the actual issues involved. So there'll be a really good discussion about that. And Yabinga Zimbabwe, who is the director of UhuruNews.com, the organization and the online voice of the International African Revolution, of which Uhuru Radio is a part, and the people saw the protest in St. Petersburg, What About the Black Community? Obama, that was a lot of interest came to Uhuru News based off of that, and he will be speaking, so that will be a really excellent event. That's going to take place at the St. Petersburg Library here in St. Pete, the main library located at 3745 9th Avenue North in St. Pete. And if you have any questions about that, it's going to start at 2 o'clock on Saturday, September 6th at the main library. With questions, you can phone 727-510-4360. That's 727-510-4360. Now, if you're in the Northern California area, there are a couple of fundraisers that you can participate in that are very important fundraisers, raising money as reparations to the African struggle. On Saturday, September 6th in San Francisco, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement will be doing, Uhuru Foods will be doing a food booth at a festival in San Francisco called Power to the Peaceful. And you are welcome and invited to participate in that if you're in the Northern California area. For more information, to sign up for volunteering with Uhuru Foods, you can phone 510-759-8154. That's 510-759-8154. And that will be an all-day event in San Francisco on this Saturday. And also on Saturday and Sunday in Mountain View, the Uhuru Foods is doing a food booth at the Mountain View Art and Wine Festival. That's in Northern California. So you can phone that same number. Or, of course, visit uhurusolidarity.org for information on that. And one final event happening again this Saturday, sponsored by the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, is in Philadelphia. The Clark Park Flea Market will be taking place, as it does, I believe, on a monthly basis, from 9 to 5. Volunteers are needed. If you are interested in vending, participating, or just coming to shop, this is a fundraiser for the Uhuru Movement. And you can reach the Uhuru Solidarity Center there in Philadelphia at 857-233-7508. That's 857-233-7508. And again, all this information you can find on the website, uhurusolidarity.org. I also want to remind people to, if you haven't already, if you're considering coming to the annual convention of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, definitely encourage you to do that. It's going to be a phenomenal convention this year, September 27th and 28th here in St. Petersburg. You should go to inpdum.org. That's the acronym for International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement.org and register now. It's a $50 registration. You should reserve your seat and come and participate in the annual convention of the Uhuru Movement. We're going to return to our program, and I just want to let people know that if you have a question, African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess is talking live in the studio with Chimerenga Waller, former president of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement and also a former candidate for school board here in Pinellas County, a longtime leader of the Uhuru Movement and longtime activist on the question of education for African children. If you have comments or questions that you'd like to direct to Chimerenga, you can contact Uhuru Radio. You can call us through your Skype. If you're on your computer, you can call at Uhuru Radio. It's the Skype ID. It's all one word, lowercase. Or you can call in through your telephone. If you're in the U.S., you can phone 727-565-1599. That's 727-565-1599, the live call-in number. If you're calling from within the U.S. And if you'd like to call in to the London, U.K. number, you can phone 440-208-133-6629. 440-208-133-6629. And, of course, you can email questions and comments as well at dj@uhururadio.com. So we're going to return to our program.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Solidarity, Not Charity. And again, we're honored to have with us in the studio Chimerenga Waller, who is the former president of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement and, excuse me, current head of the Education Committee. Is that the correct title?
Well, I'm actually heading up the on-the-ground committee for the convention at the moment.
Excellent.
I'm also dealing with the legal committee over the Javon, Justice for Javon committee.
Excellent. So, thank you for that.
People kind of see me as the expert in the movement around education.
So but many other things as well.
I don't feel like I'm an expert, but I read a little bit. So.
But you, yeah, definitely are the expert, though. So the NPDEM and the Uhuru movement also made an application to the Pinellas County School Board for a charter school. Right. Can you talk a little bit about that? And what is a charter school, and how is the charter school put together by NPDEM different than other ones?
Okay. Well, first of all, charter schools are actually public schools. In Florida, they are publicly funded per child. And in 2000, I think we actually filed an application in 99, the first time for Marcus Garvey Academy. It was going to be a charter school for 45 African students. And, of course, in 1999, they were still in the middle of this so-called court order from federal court order that said there could only be at the time 35% of the any student body could be African. It couldn't go over 35%. But in Florida, charter schools, the purpose of charter schools is to add creativity and take some of the obstacles away that keep children from being educated. That is the purpose. But in our case in Pinellas County, because of the question that the Uhuru movement would actually try to educate African children, only 45 of them, and this was going to be done at the Uhuru House, which is right in the middle of the African community. And we actually presented our case in court as they were negotiating the other issues about integration and that kind of thing. We said, well, we got a charter application that we want to put forward. And we were able to present evidence to the federal courts, Judge Maraday, that said, look, we don't understand why we can't get this charter school, because the school board looks at the charter application that we put forward that's saying that the children will be immersed in African culture. All subjects would involve African culture so the children could understand who they are. and understand the system as well. And the superintendent was definitely against that. At the time, it was Howard Hinsley. And after they read the application, they said it was one of the best they had ever seen, and then they denied it. And the reason they claimed they denied it was because it couldn't be majority white. They would require us to follow the same rules as the public schools, and it couldn't be more than 35% African. Of course, we know that that is not true, because as we presented evidence to the federal courts at that time, they didn't even have any rules prohibiting charter schools from having all black student body in that case. So they created a matrix, what they called a matrix, that would say these are the rules for creating charter schools. And what they did was put into the matrix that all charter schools would have to follow the same racial guidelines, racial quota guidelines as all other schools. Now, this doesn't make sense, because charter schools supposed to go be avoiding these obstacles that keep children from being educated. But they use that obstacle to stop Marcus Garvey Academy specifically. The target was us. It might have got other people too, but it was aimed at us, because it never came up until we said we wanted a charter school. So we are not currently working on another application to reapply for the Marcus Garvey Academy. We're going to update. We are in the process right now of updating. We had a few setbacks, but we're looking 2010-2011 school year to have that in place to apply for that school year. But this charter school application is going to be taken from the original Marcus Garvey Academy charter school application. We're going to revise it, of course, update the information. And we believe it's going to be a tremendous asset to the community. We don't think we have the same obstacles that we had at the time. Now they can't use the excuse that this, you know, it's not going to be all African, or it's not going to be a certain percentage African. They can't use that. Racial quotas have now disappeared in Pinellas County. However, they are using racial quotas through trickery. They are still doing that. As a matter of fact, I want to talk later about how they've managed to maintain racial quotas undercover in Pinellas County. But officially, there are no more racial quotas. So this would allow an all-African school to exist in Pinellas County. So we're excited about that possibility. We believe in community control of education. While a charter school is not community control over education, we do believe it is a step in the right direction to gain some kind of control over the education of African students. We're really excited about it. It's going to take about a year to get that application in. It's probably going to be, we want it to be as perfect as we can get it. We know it won't be, but it's going to take us about a year to complete that work on that application, and it'll be going in August of 2009, mm-hmm. So for the 2010-2011 school year.
Very exciting. And wasn't there, at the time that proposal was rejected, wasn't there also a white charter school in Pinellas County?
Well, there was more than one. As a matter of fact, shortly before that is when the Athenian Academy had applied as a charter school. The so-called Greek immersion, it would be Greek would be taught throughout all the classes in the school, and they had no problem with that, which essentially turned out to be an almost all-white school. They just had Greek immersion. But that is an example of how they would come up with these strange rules. Pinellas County has a unique kind of approach to the miseducation of African students. And they've gone into great detail to make sure that that happens. They created an artificial line at Ormonton Road. North of that line, they called North County. South of that line, they called South County. All schools north of Ormonton Road were not privy to racial quotas. There were no racial quotas north of Ormonton Road. However, the trick was the majority of the Africans live south of Monroe. So they knew that they weren't building in a situation where you could have an African school, because most of the African students, the vast majority of the population in Pinellas County lives in St. Petersburg. So the vast majority of Africans live in St. Petersburg as well. So they know to draw that line and say, well, no racial quotas north of the county. It can be all white schools. North of the county. It implies it could be African schools, but it's so few Africans living north of Omerton Road, it didn't matter. So you can have all white schools anywhere in the county. Under the current plan, you could have all white schools anywhere in the county, and there are all white schools that exist north of Omerton Road right now. So the legal prohibitions against African schools was clearly an attack, as part of the colonial attack on African people.
Yes, I mean, it seems like it takes so many fronts. You know, the only place that African people can really congregate is in prison, I guess.
Right.
You know,
right.
But everything else is geared to keep the African community as a whole from organizing, from coming together. But I know you talked about you were heading up the Committee for Justice for Jevon Dawson. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I don't actually head that committee. It's headed by Kobina Bantu-Shango and Diop Olukbala at the moment. But I am heading up a section that deals with the legal liaison between the actual committee and the lawyer who is the lawyer for the family. Mm-hmm. So there have been a number of issues that both legal and political issues that have presented themselves. So I'm kind of in the middle of that work. It's related to education because Jevon Dawson was a high school student,
yes,
a sophomore in high school, who was at a graduation party, a high school graduation party, who never lived to see his 18th birthday because a policeman murdered him on June the 7th. So we have been involved in that case. And we feel like the school system is murdering our children every day without pulling a trigger,
mm-hmm.
Without using a knife. They are using the actual system itself to alienate the children from their own community and destroy them. When they come out, they're the only shell of who they are. There are some very interesting statistics that were put out by the school board in 1998. One of them I find that should disturb anybody of good conscience. This study was supposed to show how the progress of African children as compared to white children, how that happened, how that progress was happening from kindergarten through second grade. Those were the only grades they compared in part of the study. And what they determined was that about 42% of the African children that came into kindergarten were not ready to go to school. About 29% of the white children were not ready. But by the time the children reached second grade, about 58% of the African students were failing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that meant is about 16% of the African students, according to their own numbers,
mm-hmm.
would have been better off actually not going to school at all, because the school system is what caused that failure.
Right.
So they didn't say those were failing. They said those failed after they got there. So I think this is really disturbing kind of information to know that the children come in okay, they're fine. And then by the time they reach second grade, mere 2 years later, now you find 16% more failing than it was in kindergarten.
This is so outrageous. And I think that, you know, this whole thing that we started out talking about, the two-tiered, the whole experience of public education for white people versus for the African
right.
community. And, you know, not just the fact that African children, you know, are treated horribly by their teachers and hated, and you know, but of course the psychological and emotional impact on that, as well as the political impact of facing the police in many schools and here in Pinellas County as well. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the big urban areas, it's like a police state inside of the schools. Right. You know, we were talking about the impact on African children of this experience.
Yeah. In Florida, about 26% of the out-of-school suspensions is African boys. About 10% is white males. And this number is astronomical in the fact that African people in this whole state don't make up a 20% of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So to see 26% mm-hmm. of the out-of-school suspensions be African people, this doesn't make sense. Doesn't make statistical sense.
No.
If you're just somebody who goes into this situation, read the numbers and say, well, we're going into this thing assuming it's race neutral, then how do you explain that 26% of the out-of-school suspensions is going to African males? That doesn't make any sense at all. How can you explain that only a third of the African children are graduating with diplomas in Florida? Now they say 25% graduation work rate for African boys in the state of Florida. There's no way you can explain that.
Yes.
There's no way to explain that. If the children are being educated, there's no way to explain that. We were talking earlier before we started the show. I think I was relating some numbers to you about so-called positive. The study was supposed to be pointing out, the Economic Policy Institute was supposed to be pointing out positive aspects of how the school system is helping to educate African children. And they were pointing out the fact that in 1990, on the fourth grade math test, the African students scored about a 188 and the white students scored 220. 17 years later, in 2007, the African school students scored 222 on the test, the white students scored 248. And they were really cheering the fact
mm-hmm.
that the African student achievement on math, fourth grade math, went up 6 percentage points. But that was 17 years to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they didn't talk about was the 28 points that the white students' achievement went up.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make any sense to be cheering these kind of numbers. And the African students are doing it, notwithstanding the fact that nobody's trying to educate them, they're doing it against the grain. It just seems to me this is nothing to cheer about. We have to take a serious look at educating our own children. That's why we're trying to do the Marcus Garvey Academy. That's why we're pushing all our organizations all over the country to do the same kind of thing we're trying to do in this county.
Well, before we close today, I definitely would like to see if you could talk about the upcoming convention, what it's going to mean, and the programmatic thrust of that Impedum is building. You know, I know there's a
revolutionary National Democratic Program.
National Democratic Program, of which the question of education is a part. So
right,
please
right.
talk about that.
And while the Revolutionary National Democratic Program is still sort of in development, and this is the first time it's going to actually be rolled out full-fledged at this convention. I'm really excited about that. This convention is going to be happening on September 27th and 28th right here in St. Petersburg, Florida, at 1245 18th Avenue South. That's the Uhura House. And we're going to be bringing our members from all over the country. As a matter of fact, speaking, we have a confirmation now from one presidential candidate, Cynthia McKinney, who is running from, I think she's running with the Green Party under another name, but she's running from the Green Party. We've invited Barack Obama's campaign. We've invited John McCain's campaign to come. We're really excited about this convention because all our forces get the chance to ask all the candidates or their representatives, what about the black community?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you going to do for the black community? Because this has been taken off the radar, and Barack Obama, of course, has helped to take it off the radar by saying 90% of the racial questions in America have been solved. And this is absurd, given the statistics that I just laid out for the last hour. This is absurd to be saying that 90% of the racial questions in America have been solved. So this convention is going to have the theme, "What about the Black community?" Mm-hmm. And I think it now then centers the question of African oppression and the struggle for African liberation squarely in the center of the discussion and on the table again, finally. So I'm really excited about the 27th and 28th and look forward to it.
Is the convention open to supporters from the white community?
Yes, it is open. As a matter of fact, NPDOM, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, is open to all nationalities. It's a $35 membership fee. The convention has a $50 registration fee, and you can go online to inpdum.org, register online, pay your $50, and love to see you there at the convention.
Is there a phone number that people can call?
Yes, you can call 821, area code 727-821-6620. That's the number here at the Uhura House. We have an on-the-ground committee that's doing a lot of the logistical work right here in St. Petersburg, so we'll be able to give you any other numbers that you need to move forward.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Chimurenga Waller. It's been an honor to have you on our show today, and we're looking forward to the NPDOM convention, September 27th and 28th.
I am too.
I think it's going to be powerful. So, Uhuru.
Uhuru.
And this concludes this week's broadcast of Solidarity Not Charity. We hope you tune in again next week. Tell your friends. Also, we hope that you have subscribed. We want to thank all of the subscribers to uhururadio.com that are, for a minimum of $10 a month, receiving your weekly download of new and historic speeches by African People's Socialist Party Chairman Amalia Shetela. If you have not yet subscribed, go to uhururadio.com to the subscribe page. Do so today. Uhururadio.com relies upon your contributions and your support and your subscriptions to continue to develop bureaus and branches and studios throughout the African world. And so I want to thank all of those who have subscribed in this recent period and welcome you to the uhururadio.com family. So this, again, also concludes today's broadcast of uhururadio.com. Tune in again next Sunday and every Sunday from 8 a.m. Eastern to 5 p.m. Eastern. Uhuru.